My name is Tala Chaudhary. I'm 69 years old. And I'm going to be 69 years old in June. And today is the 23rd of February 2019. And we are in Chicago. I'm here with my daughter, Simi. And I'm really looking forward to this interview.
And my name is Simi Chaudhary. I am 30 years old. Today is Saturday, February 23rd, 2019. We are in the Windy City, City of Chicago, and I am the daughter of Talat Chaudhary, my mother. So to get things started, I think it would be great. We were doing a little bit of this before we walked in, but if you had five words to describe yourself, what would be those five words?
Versatile, vivacious, friendly, gentle, kind.
Those are great words. And can you tell me more about what you mean when you say vivacious?
Vivacious means someone full of life and being positive and making things work.
And that's a great way of describing yourself, I think, especially as your daughter. I can see how you've done that on a number of times. Making things work. What is your earliest memory of when you had to make things work?
Can I add alhamdulillah, which is, you know, anything that we praise, we are praising. We immediately think of God, Allah, and we invoke it that it is because of Allah, because of Him. Anything good that I have in me.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you. Mm-hmm. We must always be reminded of our gratitude. Yes. And you've done a really good job at that as well, raising us with an attitude of gratitude.
Yes.
So within the spirit of kind of making things work, when do you think, if you were to take a moment and kind of go through the memory archives, when was your first experience of when you had to make things work?
When I got married, my parents had paired me off with the best person who came to our door, the best family, the best person. And when I flew over to the United States, the immense distance was... It was just like unending. I had not imagined United States being so far that the airplane journey was not ending. And, this was 44 years ago. The flight would take 22 hours. It had five stops. So you could never really like fully relax because it was just, you know, taking off and landing. And I started like getting depressed. And I was with my husband, newly married. We had stayed a month in the country. And started asking my husband, how long is it going to take? And he said, no, it's going to be a little while. And then I asked again the same question. And I think probably when I asked the third time, he said, okay, go to sleep. So I put my head in his lap and went to sleep. And it was all, you know, like it's the custom back home. When you're married, you have to dress up in your finery, nice clothes, your gold jewelry. So I was wearing my very nice gold earrings. They looked like heavy, but they were really light, very pretty, attractive. And the air hostesses, it caught their attention. And they saw this young couple, nice looking. And they were calm and, you know, were paying attention to us. So the long journey, so I knew I was like flying over to the U.S., you know, when I was in college, there was one girl who was getting married to someone in the U.S. and I always wished for that. Mm. So this was happening. This was a wish come true. But never did I realize that it was going to be so far away.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so like within that spirit, you had to make it work. Because it was something that you had anticipated, but now it was sort of the reality was facing you much harder than you had thought.
When I got my visa, from the U.S. Embassy. My brother-in-law, husband's younger brother, was visiting from Greece. And he started teasing me that, in our language, kya maza aayega, you know, he was teasing me like being sarcastic that now you will see. So I didn't understand at that point what he meant, because to me, everything seemed so exciting. I think later on I understood that he meant that I will be so depressed, feeling so missing the family so much.
Right.
Yeah.
And within, I want to take a moment and recognize sort of what you mean when you say family, because in your life, family is really big. You come from a family with 11 siblings. You held a very close relationship with your mother, our maternal grandmother, with your grandfather. With your father, who's our grandfather. Mm-hmm. There's a number of times in which you've shared some really unique experiences and interactions that you had with both your mom and your father that made you into the young woman that you became, and then the woman and the mother and the sort of wife that you were. Mm-hmm. So perhaps you can share a little bit about what it was like. You use this term, you know, my parents had paired me off. Yeah. And so I'd really like for you to describe, you know, being a young woman in Pakistan, and what that was, what did that look like when it was time then to start this next chapter of your life, which was getting married?
Yeah, I think there are many things in one question.
Yeah.
So I will focus on being paired off. In my family, there were six boys and five daughters. There was like a row of four boys and a row of four girls, and then two boys and, you know, another daughter. So my older brothers were like, you know, next to our dad. You know, we were sometimes even more scared of them than our dad. Our dad was more like a friend. I mean, he would teach us things in a friendly manner. And our brothers were very sweet, but, you know, we were like a little bit scared of them sometimes. And then I have two older sisters, and I'm the seventh in line among the younger siblings. And
didn't your father call you something?
Like, yeah.
There was a...
And I was, since I think it, I had a very cheerful personality, I was very friendly, and I was close to my mom. So family started calling me Lado, which means the favorite one. And my earliest memory of my childhood is when I'm clinging to my mom's leg. We were in our ancestral village. We would go there once a year. Usually in wintertime, and I'm clinging to my mom's leg, and my cousins are teasing me, Lado, Lado. So that is my earliest memory of my childhood. And I would always, you know, being close to your mom is you will always want to do what pleases her. And I knew that whatever she's saying is for my own good. She was a disciplinarian, but she was always gentle, nice with me, because I was always the law-abiding.
The favorite one.
The law-abiding.
Right, and the favored one.
Yeah.
And so there was a lot of trust then that you had placed in both of your parents for them to ultimately make the decision of who you were going to marry.
Yeah, and also because I was religious, you know, in our religion, you have to pray five times, you have to dress appropriately. So I think when I was at that age, I was still wearing dresses and not covering my legs. So one day came, my mom said, okay, now you're grown up, you have to cover your legs, means like wear pants, shalwar. Shalwar is the local pant. You have to wear shalwar, and now you have to start saying your prayers. Mm-hmm. So from that day onwards, I started saying five-time prayers. It came so easily. Mm-hmm. And before that, there was a short period of time I was feeling, why isn't my mom checking on me, you know, like reprimanding me that I'm just doing whatever I like dressing the way I like. So one day came, she had to just say it once, and everything fell in place.
And so there is. There's always been, even as your daughter, I've heard, you know, a number of times in which you've described what something that you learned from our grandmother, something that she shared with you. And it was always within the spirit of, I only had to hear it once. And after that, I knew, like, and in some cases it was not even hearing it, it was just seeing it, like that look. Yeah. Right? Can you describe that look?
Yeah. You know, I became conscious of that look we are referring to when I was married and already with kids. And once we were visiting, we were back home and we had gone up to the hill town of Murray, you know, where people go in summer, and we had a cottage. So, you know, four of us were married, the sisters. I think all of us were married by then. And we were talking about our kids, you know, like a little bit small complaints here and there. And my mom was listening all this time. She was quiet and she was listening. She only said one sentence. She said, you know, when your kids grow taller than you, you have to respect them. So, and that by that time, I was beginning to realize that my mom is not giving us that look, you know. It was just not, she didn't have to put it in words. It was just one look and we would freeze. That whatever we have said or done was not appropriate.
Yeah.
So, and we would become conscious, and it didn't have to be put in words again, because it was said once, and once was enough.
I'm pretty sure that when that happened, I was still at your knees, or maybe I wasn't even born yet. So I wasn't going to get that respect just yet.
And if you didn't, you know, if you kept on doing like being a belligerent, then there came the thappar.
Right.
From the dad, not the mom.
Right. And so I want to take a moment and kind of, because this was a big part, there was a big sort of juncture that took place. You know, you were, I believe, 23 years old, leading up to the moment in which you got married to dad.
Yeah.
And got married to Abuji.
Mm-hmm.
And before then, there, so sort of setting the stage that before then, there was a moment where you've shared with us, you were in a kind of a geography class or a history class. And you had learned about a country in Latin America, which was and you described it in a particular way. So can you walk me through that process of, because you knew you were going to another country.
Yeah.
You signed up for a marriage in which you were going to leave Pakistan and go to the United States. But what you didn't know was what was going to happen a couple of years later. So can you talk a little bit about that?
The previous question, I think, had a second part to it. Like about getting paired.
Right.
And I didn't get to, you know, talk about that. So I can answer the current question now and then go back.
Yeah. Right.
I think I was in first grade, which is fourth grade in my childhood. And we were doing geography, and we were studying different countries where oil is produced. Like, you know, there's oil is found. And Venezuela came up. And I mean, some of the other countries I had heard and I was familiar. And this was a long name, I felt a weird name. What a strange name. And little did I know that after being married and being here in the United States for just a little over a year, 16 months, I will be moving to Venezuela. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were moved for 18 months, but, you know, I will elaborate later on how long we stayed.
I was born there.
Yes, yeah. We moved with an 8-month-old child and moved back 22 years later. Of course, every year we were getting home leave, coming back to get our paperwork renewed. And then every other year, we would get that done, and every other year we would fly over to Pakistan, usually during summertime when the kids were school going. And so we ended up being there 22 years. And my spouse, Tawseef, he stayed another 2 years, putting in 6 weeks there of work and coming back for 2 weeks, working here also. So that way we got to see each other. We put up with that for 2 more years. And then, you know, the three of us decided, my older daughter, Shafak, and Simi, and myself, we don't want the money, we want the man, because, you know, we were still getting the overseas allowances and all the perks, and with my husband working there. And we decided, no, enough was enough. We have made use of this for not 18 months, so it has passed 18 years also, so now we want him back.
Right.
So he came back after 24 years, and he was made the division head for 7 countries. And we saw less of him when he came back.
Well, and yeah, and I want to take a moment of pause and kind of recognize how much has happened in that time period, because you described, basically over 2 decades, which is quite significant.
Yeah.
You know, in that process, you became a mother, right? Like to my oldest brother, Asad Bhai, and then, you know, you, after 8 months after becoming a mother, you then moved to Venezuela. So perhaps you can walk us through, walk me through what that felt like. I can't imagine for myself what it would be like to uproot so quickly, you know, after having such monumental things happen, right? Like getting married and then having a child. Mm-hmm. So do you remember how you felt, you know, in those moments between moving and becoming a mother?
Right. While growing up, I had heard, over different occasions that he got an overseas assignment, and that meant, it's a huge deal. You're going to get paid more, you will be traveling more, and it will be all company expense. So when my husband brought it up, I was all for it. I encouraged him. And because I knew he was like one of the top-notch professionals, he was like brilliant as a student. He finished his master's at Iowa State in a year and a half. And then not only that, he was also working. He got some work on the side. And then he got a job right away, and he stayed with that job all his life. So I knew it was going to be a good thing for us. And here we were, I studied all my schooling, not college. The school years were in the convent. My dad, who was in the army, it was the tradition to send the boys off to army, to cadet colleges, and the daughters to convents. So we had exposure of the nuns and of different people. One of my teachers was from Ceylon, from Sri Lanka, it was called at that time. So that had opened up our minds to variety, to multi-religion, multicultural. I think it was huge. And also, one thing that I noticed with my dad, especially, after coming overseas, was that when you hear so much about bias and racism and prejudice, that my dad never, ever, even once referred to skin color or any like economic class, someone being superior or inferior, or talking in any form of bias or religious or color, religious or cultural bias. Mm-hmm. So that is how I grew up with.
And I think that made a big impact in a number of ways. And I can say for myself, for example, when it was time for me to go to another high school, which I advocated quite hard for, it was easier for you. It wasn't easy, but it was certainly easier for you when I asked about going to an all-girls Catholic high school to switch from Islamic school, and there was a level of familiarity there, given that you, you were sharing just now, went to convent school.
Yes.
So I guess I'm there's a couple things that you said there that I'm curious about. And I hear, because as your daughter, I've always, and as someone who's been a beneficiary of your worldview, and the fact that you are, I would say, a global citizen, right? Like you've traveled a lot, you've experienced a lot from a young age. I am curious to know kind of, I've always seen you as my mom as an anomaly. Like, you are a nutritionist, you are a naturopath, you are an educator, you're someone who is a very determined person as well. And not to say that there's not, of course, there's a lot of people that are determined in our world, but an anomaly in comparison to your peers. And so, when I take a step back and kind of look around and see a lot of your peers, like South Asian women of the same age group, a lot of times they married a doctor, right? And like, dad is, Abuji's not a doctor. Abuji's a hydroelectric engineer. So like, clearly that wasn't something, I mean, I'm just assuming now, but it seemed as though it wasn't something that was important to you. There might have been something that was different that was important to you. So I want you to share like a little bit about what has led you into these paths, you know, like a Pakistani mother who speaks Spanish, who like Venezuela is a huge part of you. Pakistan's a huge part of you. America is a United States of America is a huge part of you. Like, what is it in you that has allowed you to like take the, you know, not to take, what is it called? Like the path less traveled, right?
Yeah. Less trodden.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel I am so privileged, so fortunate to have had a great childhood. My father was educated. He had done law at one of the top-notch colleges. He was morally conscious. He was also very religious, but with a very open mind. He never enforced things on us. We were taught all the basics, you know, of tenets of the religion, and then he gave us the choice. And he was a very loving, sweet person. So I tried to incorporate all of those in my character. And he was the oldest child. There were five males in the family and one female. And all five of them grew up in the village. My father, my grandfather was a land owner, but he was also educated. He was working with, at that time it was a British colony, and he was working as a clerk, my grandfather, which was the highest position that you could get. And he was in the irrigation department, which meant that, you know, you got some perks. For example, one of the biggest perks was that your land got 2.5 times the allotment of water, and water is a scarce commodity. And we have artificial irrigation, as I mentioned, you know, from the big river, they make smaller streams, and then from the smaller streams, even smaller ones. So, and he made sure that his kids got a good schooling. He started, our village was 3 miles away from the closest city, which is called Sargodha. And he even started a school there. So once they had done the basic elementary schooling in the village, probably I think they went to that school. And there were no railroads, no metal roads. I mean, transportation was extremely poor. All that you could go on was a bullock cart, which was very slow. You know, only the farmers used that to haul cargo, or donkeys. So they would ride donkeys to cover the 3 mile stretch each day to go to school in Sargodha. So from there on, they got enrolled in FCC College, which is Foreman Christian College, which was one of the elite colleges of the country, which the British had set up. And they had, at that time, it was pre-partition, you know, there was no India or Pakistan, it was just one country. So they had British professors, it was like the top-notch education you could get. So all five boys, one after the other, they got admission there. My dad was the oldest, he did law. The one younger to him did med studies, he became a doctor. The third one did something in Persian, and he would be reciting Persian poetry just off his, you know, off his head anytime. And he would just get so deeply into it. And the fourth one is still alive in Ottawa. He's an aeronautical engineer. He did his master's in Purdue. And last year I had the good opportunity of going to meet with him. And the youngest one, he was a dentist. And after his studies, undergrad studies in FCC, he was sent overseas to England to get further education. The two youngest ones and my dad, you know, financed both of them to come. So he had the vision, you know, that, you know, they need to get more higher studies.
So it seems like if you were to draw a line between the what you've just shared right now and we were to call that line something, it would be called, this is my assessment, education.
Yes.
And so why is education so important? I want you to share. You shared a little bit about why that is, but I want you to talk about
on my
the
dad's
importance
side,
of it.
Yeah, thank you. On my dad's side of the family, education was a huge priority. My mom's side of the family, they lived like two train stations away. They were like 3 miles away from the train station. My dad's village was half a mile from the train station, and that was huge because there was no transportation. And my maternal grandfather had much more lands, you know, huge tracts of land compared to my paternal grandfather, who had like 1/4 of what my maternal grandfather had. But, you know, my paternal grandfather was educated. He had the vision. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so he put that into action, his vision, put that, and he got his sons educated. Whereas it was the mentality before that if you owned so much land, then, you know, the kids became lax, especially the males. They didn't want to be educated. There weren't that many opportunities. And as in my dad's case, they were closer to the city of Sargodha. They were closer to the train station later on when the trains came into form. And so they had the advantage of shorter distance and plus the vision of my grandfather.
And how does that, how sort of kind of within that story, because there's kind of what we were saying earlier, like there's determination, there's perseverance. How did that ultimately impact you?
Yes. I think I still have to finish the first part. That education has just like, my family has just gone up socioeconomically, whereas my mom's side of the family has gone down socioeconomically because of lack of education. Mm. And because no one got really like college education in that family, so they're still struggling with education. They are getting their kids educated, but they still continue living in the village and they have not progressed.
Whereas you got both an undergraduate and a graduate education.
Right, yeah.
And you received both of those in, where was it? In Pakistan,
in
right?
In home economics, yeah.
Yeah. And ultimately, like, you even pushed yourself into a PhD program as
right.
well.
Right, yes. You know, when I was growing up, if you didn't get into, like, med school, you know, you had to do have some basics in sciences in order to get, go to med school or engineering school. And engineering school was not popular for girls. It was only med school. So I didn't make the cut for the med school. So my oldest brother, who was also in the army, he probably had come across some families, some friends, who were sending their daughters to home economics, which was a new school, college set up by the Ford Foundation, U.S. Ford Foundation. Mm-hmm. And so he had heard great things about that. So what ended up happening was I was not happy in the college I was going to in my parents' city in Rawalpindi. So he pulled me out of that college, convinced my parents. My parents were confused. They didn't know what was happening.
Yeah.
So he put me into this home economics college. And once I went there, I started college. I was dorming. It opened up a whole new world for me.
And can you say, Ami, just in a few words, what is home economics?
Home economics, I was studying nutrition, housing, and clothing and textiles, housing, childcare, family relations, everything, psychology was thrown in everything, in food, how you present it, in clothes, how you dress up, everything mattered, you know, it was psychology. And in the type of environment you're living in the type of clothes you're wearing, in the type of food you're eating and presenting, everything was related to psychology. Mm-hmm. So, and my professors, they had come to the U.S. and they had studied here. They had done their post-graduation studies here. So they were all enlightened. So I was like a completely different person. I was so happy. I was so motivated. And I made the most of it.
And it's like you said something that's really, I think, a very important part to, I find within South Asian families, immigrant families, mm-hmm. it's individuals who come from the subcontinent. Now, this is a broad statement, but mm-hmm. if I were to assess it in a few words, I would say that in many ways, social mobility is largely hinged on education. Mm-hmm. And so when, especially, you know, like when you and Abu came to the United States, it was sort of this like, we're going to receive higher education, because Abu first came here to get his mm-hmm. master's and ultimately joined him as well. Mm-hmm. And there is this, you know, there's like this American dream we're going to realize. And it includes, you know, mobility. In your case, mobility was a huge part of it, because you moved to the United States. And even while you were here, you moved to a couple different states. You were both in Virginia and in Illinois. Yeah. And then, but then ultimately you took like the grand voyage to Venezuela. Mm-hmm. So if we could shift gears a little bit, I want to kind of focus on perhaps like what it was like for you as someone who didn't speak Spanish, as someone mm-hmm. who was still wearing those, you know, beautiful golden earrings, because you're still kind of technically a newlywed. Mm-hmm. Now you're a new mother mm-hmm. and you've landed on this foreign land, which ultimately became home for us and mm-hmm. became my birth country, a place that I share dual citizenship with. So I want, perhaps you can tell me a little bit more about what that felt like being there, and what it was about Venezuela that ultimately made that feel like home for you.
Yeah, I think I came with a huge advantage. When I was doing my post-grad studies in home economics, I had done my undergrad, and then I joined the post-grad studies. When we were close to the end of that two-year period, it was the largest group ever, 22 of us. The principal called in all of us and she, you know, spoke to us. So after that, she made a job offer to me to work in the college. And I looked at that job offer. I thought about it. I was away from home for 6 years. And I said, no, I cannot do that. I want to go back to my family. So I
didn't. How old were you when that happened?
I was, I think, like 20, 21.
Okay.
Yeah. So I didn't even consult with my parents. But I told the principal that, you know, my family has not agreed that I should accept this job. Because I just wanted to get out of that. I've been there for 6 years away from home, and I wanted to be back. So that gave me a huge boost, that out of 22 students, I was chosen. And also while growing up, you know, being like called the favorite one, and, you know, having a personality that was always attracting attention and getting love from others, from family, friends, everyone, it gave me further self-esteem. Mm-hmm. So I didn't accept this job. Then I got another job interview. And I got selected as lecturer to start a new home economics department. It was one of the very popular fields. And I believe in the 50s, it was one of the most popular fields in the U.S. Mm. So I got this job offer, and I'm being interviewed by this group. One of them was the principal of the college I was being interviewed for. Then there was a brigadier and a third person I don't remember. So one of the questions that was asked was how many, it was not correct, that question. How many, it should have been calories are there in this type of food? Mm-hmm. So I very politely, you know, I said, how many calories? They had used another word.
Okay.
So, you know, I was confident to be able to correct that gently. So that must have given them the impression that I know what I'm doing. So I accepted that job. It was in another town. I had to commute. We were given a place to stay.
What was the town called?
Vaughan.
Okay.
Over there is the Pakistan's largest ammunition industry. Mm-hmm. So I started working in that college. We were given a place. It wasn't that appropriate, that place. You know, we were just given a couple of rooms, which were like, you know, the stage, the rooms behind the stage. So we were there. It was a temporary arrangement. Excuse me. We stayed there for a year, and then later on we found some other place. So I had worked almost a year and a half before I got married. And when the match with with my, you know, where I was getting married was finalized, I decided to leave my job because I didn't like the living arrangement. So I stayed home for, I think it was like a couple of months, and did all the sewing for my, I made my own bridal dress. I made dresses for my sisters, beautiful ones, and very complicated ones, you know, like on the stitching of
embroidery,
different color materials on the bias and the garara. So I got a lot of satisfaction from that because before I decided to do it on my own, I was going from one tailor to another, and I had given something to be sewn, and it was not right. So since I learned how to sew, I decided to do it. For 2 months, I was sitting on the machine and made all my trousseau, my clothes that I was going to wear, most of them. So I came with the advantage, a boost, a distinct advantage when I got married. I had a postgraduate degree, which gave me the equivalency of 16 years of education here, of undergrad, and I had 16 years of education there because our high school is up to 10 grades, and then we have 4 years undergrad, and then 2 years.
Because of the A-levels and O-levels.
So I felt that every girl should get a master's degree. When I was getting in, I said, what a bummer, girls are getting married. And now, you know, once I got, came over here, I said, that was such a huge advantage. And then when I started working as a high school English teacher, it was based on that experience.
Well, and that's what really helped, right?
Yes.
Because I remember you've shared with us, because this was before, I think, either my sister or I, either Shafak or I were, was born, that there was a point when you were now living in Guri, in Venezuela, where there was, maybe you can describe that interaction with the at the school where you ended up teaching.
So I wanted to emphasize that when I got married, I was moving, coming with the, as an advantaged person, you know, with the education, with the job experience, and with the, I was going to get the undergrad equivalency, and that's huge. So we were here, and as soon as we came, I went with my spouse. I requested him to take me to the education department. I want to see how I can get my equivalency.
And where were you?
We were in Chicago. We have not moved yet.
Okay.
And so we came, and they said, you know, I will need this, this, this. Then, you know, I was expecting, not feeling too, you know, like
home. Which education department was this?
I don't remember, but I came with him on the train to the city.
Okay.
Yeah. So getting to be a mom right away, you know, expecting my first child, nauseated. So that I put that on the back burner. And then, you know, soon I had my first child. He was the most adorable baby I'd seen. And my husband already had, you know, some experience with his niece, Nagma, whom he adored. And so he'd help out a lot, and I was the happiest person. I think that took care of my homesickness, having a baby right away.
Right.
Yeah.
And that baby, who's my older brother, Asad Bhai, at some point ended up being your student, was it?
No, I've taught in the same school, in the international school.
Right,
yeah,
right.
He was 8 months old when we moved, and then 2 years, 1 month. One day later, I had my second one.
Yeah.
So Kashif, Asad is the older one, and they have been, like, close to each other. They have been, like, inseparable. They have been friends and everything. Good unit. So it was great having them. You know, I would have planned to have the 2-3 years apart, but since we moved to Venezuela and there was help available, my friends started talking me into having the second one soon. So that's how it happened.
Right.
Yeah.
And then you always talk about how you really, really wanted a daughter.
You know, when Kashif was 5 years old, I was registering them for school. Mm-hmm. And when the principal noticed my education and said, would you be interested in working here next year? I said, sure. So that's where I got hired as the high school English teacher. Mm-hmm. And I worked there for 2 years. And so Asad and Kashif were in the same school.
In what town was this?
This was in Guri. You know, there was an existing dam, but they wanted to enlarge it, which ended up becoming among the 10th largest dams in the world. And they had the U.S. company Bechtel, which is very famous for this project. They had worked in Pakistan on the Mangla Dam, and they were hired to do the work.
And
And they,
how long were you
guys
there
for? It
was
a great job offer, getting paid in U.S. dollars and all the perks. And plus, when we had the first meeting, not meeting, but like a first social to meet the teachers, two of them had lived in Pakistan. And they went gaga when they saw that someone from Pakistan was there. They were super excited. And they spoke about all the great experience in Pakistan. In the 60s, there were no labor problem, labor unrest. No one had ever heard about that. They finished their project 1 year ahead of time, and they got a huge bonus from that. And they, it was one of the great experiences.
And what ultimately led to a very strong infrastructure for not only that town, but the region.
It was like a called Little America. We went on a field trip to Mangla Dam. And when it was the people were there, the Americans were there, they had their bowling alley and everything. And it was just great being able to visit there.
And how long were you in Guri for, Amin?
We were in Guri for 8 years.
Okay.
Yeah. And my husband, he just loved it. He played tennis after work.
Yeah.
And we had just the boys at that point. And then, of course, wanted to have a daughter. And it just happened.
Because Baji is the only one that was born in Guri, right?
Yes, yeah. So my second and third one are 7 years apart. Mm-hmm. So it's just, for me, it was like raising two set of kids. But I've thoroughly enjoyed the boys and the girls. So after Shapak was like 4 years old, she started, my friends would come, and I remember one of my Nigerian friends was home, and she went up to her and said, "Do you have a sister?" So at that point, I felt, oh my God, I have enjoyed my sister so much. We are so close to each other up to this day. And then I started wishing for her sister, and it just happened, So we have two surprise babies whom we love, we adore, we've enjoyed.
I remember going around and I think I was like a kid, and I would say, do you know that I was a surprise baby? And then my sister was like, "You're not supposed to go around and promote that to the whole world, And so I didn't really realize what that totally meant, but certainly have felt within the spirit of attitude of gratitude, what a blessing it is to have an older sister and to share
definitely.
In that. We've always seen it modeled with you and your sisters, that value of sisterhood, and I'm very grateful for that.
And I was, when I was expecting my third child, we were in Guri, which is a very remote place, but one of the best on-site camps in the world. So they hired the best doctors. They had very good hospital facilities. So Dr. Cardenas is the one who was my doctor. And he would each time say that it's a boy. And I would plead with him, "Please let me be happy for 9 months." And till the end, he said, "The heartbeat is so strong, it's a boy." And even at one of the socials, my husband's boss, he said, "Let me look at your hand or teacup." No, first he asked the history, because they could see that I was expecting a baby, and he wanted to know the history. So 5 males on my husband's side, 6 males on my side, and then my father, 5 males and 1 sister, and my mom had 4 brothers and 3. He said, "It's going to be a boy." So everywhere there was indication that it's a boy. So when we had Shafak, even the doctor, we were so thrilled that it was a girl. We were so happy, and I would dress her up in the finest clothes. Not that I didn't do that with the boys. I would just enter any store and pick up anything I liked and dress her up.
Because now you could play dress up.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah.
And then 5 years later, we had a surprise baby, Simi, whom she was adorable, so like a Snow White, so lovable, and the siblings enjoyed so much, and I have thoroughly enjoyed. And when I was expecting you, it's so funny, I told my second son, Kashif, that I'm expecting, and he got so excited, Almanac.
That was his way of showing his excitement.
That was his excitement. I said, gosh, you're not supposed to do that. He didn't know what to do. He just had my neck.
Wow.
And then I asked them, my husband and them, what they would like to have. And all three of them said a boy. And I said, what are you going to do with the third boy? Let it be a girl.
Yeah.
So we're so grateful that
your prayers were answered.
Yes. We were so grateful that we had a second daughter. And my oldest brother, he wrote me a letter after he heard about our fourth child. And I remember he said, how can you plan things so well? And he was referring to, like, you know, I've had two boys and then two girls.
Right.
And I said, alhamdulillah, it's all from God, from Allah.
And
he's been very kind, very grateful to me. I had an extraordinary husband, extraordinary family. He comes from a very, very good family. They're all very sweet, loving. And I just cannot express myself. I have enough words to thank
God.
Him. Thank God,
yeah.
You know, for my good fortune and good upbringing.
Thank you. Yes. Well, within the spirit of...
And good kids, good husband.
In the spirit of thanking God and being grateful, I'm grateful for the time that you took to share a piece,
yes.
A small piece of your story with me,
yes.
This afternoon. Amiji, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for bringing me here.